making sure that I say things in the right manner anymore, because
I think that very thing causes a lot of men to you know, they're tiptoeing around in the university. Now, I work in a university environment, so, you know, I see that aspect of the world. Maybe my aspect is different, but I see men, you know, almost cowering on university campuses because of fear. You know, they might say the wrong thing or get canceled or whatever else goes on.
All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Space Tomatoes podcast. I'm Havoc, and we've got your other host.
Alex, hello, welcome.
And today we have a special guest, Dr. Mark J. DeFont. He is a professor of geology and geochemistry at the University of South Florida. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Well, good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Awesome, awesome. So, found each other on Podmatch, and you know, you have a new paper out. It's a new paper you've published. You want to give us a little like overview?
Sure. You mean about the paper?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, I got interested in evolution of psychology a long time ago, and of recent, I've just been reading an immense amount on it, and started to feel like I had the background to publish papers in it. As you alluded to when you introduced me, I'm not really by training an evolutionary psychologist. My expertise is in geochemistry, and I've studied volcanoes for years. But evolutionary psychology got me so interested, I kind of now dabble in it. One of the things that struck me was that feminists were attacking a whole field of evolutionary psychology. And I started delving into it in the feminist literature and realized that it was really because evolutionary psychology was not agreeing with their ideology. It wasn't a matter that they were finding evidence to suggest that evolutionary psychology was wrong. In fact, I've seen in the feminist literature where they're saying, "Hey, you know, I can see why people are interested in this. It does ring true, but we've got to stop this messaging right away because, you know, it doesn't go along with what we want." And that's, in my opinion, that's the wrong way to take science. I'm really science first kind of world. So I make all my decisions based on, you know, what science tells me and what the data tells me. And coming from, you know, a research background in science, I feel like maybe I bring a fairly unique set of tools, you know, to the table about evolutionary psychology and social constructionism. I got a fly flying around here. Anyway, we're in Florida, so that's what you expect. Ultimately, feminists are promoting this idea of social constructionism. Do you or your audience, you think they know anything about this? Or is that something I should go into?
Let's go ahead and go into that a bit.
Social constructionism is this idea that we're born with a blank slate. We have no instincts. We learn everything through culture, and it's actually you know, the complete opposite of what evolutionary psychology is saying, that, you know, we come into the world with a lot of instincts and behaviors. Primarily, masculinity and femininity are actually behaviors, so to speak, that we've inherited from thousands and thousands of years, hundreds of thousands, really, of evolution in hunter-gatherer society. So civilization has just been too short for evolution to have impacted us, the 10,000 years of civilization, from an evolutionary perspective, has not had time to select for different behaviors. So we kind of bring into civilization a caveman kind of mentality, if you will, and those are left over from what was needed to survive in hunter-gatherer society. And that ultimately seems to fly in the face of what feminists want society to be. And I think that one thing is doing an immense amount of harm to young men in particular, but also I think to young women, because it misunderstands what evolutionary psychology is about. We're not trying to say we need to behave the way hunter-gatherers did. It's just that we have to recognize that we have some of the characteristics that evolved in hunter-gatherer society that we bring in today that forms our opinions and our ideas on society. And I'd like to eventually get into some of that if you agree. But ultimately, I think that's the bugaboo with the feminists. And when I started looking at the feminist literature, I really saw a lack of rigor in their approach. Social construction doesn't offer, or at least what they're saying social construction is, doesn't offer any alternatives data-wise. I never hear when I'm talking to a social constructionist, I never hear from them, oh, well, here's the evidence that suggests that social constructionism is correct. They simply argue against evolutionary psychology. And a lot of the ways they argue against evolutionary psychology is simply that it doesn't agree with their ideology, and that sometimes they'll even say that it's trying to take us backwards. It's not. It's just trying to tell us that we may have been selected in the past for behaving this way, and we have to deal with that in society. Whether we want to act in that way or not is up to us, but we should know about it.
So when you say, I guess one thing I would like to clarify and have some clarification on, right? I think you've got the more classical feminist, which I think there is a good deal of rigor in those studies. Which is, what brought about the civil rights movements, et cetera, right? And I think there's a good amount of information in those that are in the classical that I see there could be benefit to. So when you're talking about this particular field, you're talking about more of the, I guess I would try and use the term neo-feminists, right?
I'm not sure I would separate them, because this attitude towards evolutionary psychology has really been around since almost the second wave of feminism back in the 60s. So, no, I don't think I would separate my criticism. I think that what the feminists have done in giving a great deal of freedom to women is an outstanding thing. And I think that you will find that I'm in favor of all the good things that have happened to women because of equal rights. But from a scientific perspective, I'm worried about what we're teaching our students, or what feminist studies is teaching our students. And it doesn't seem to be related much to the truth. And we can go into the specifics if you'd like. And I appreciate you bringing that up, because I don't want people to think that I'm against women. I'm certainly not. I'm married to a woman. I have a daughter. I have a sister. Had a mother at one time. So,
No way.
I'm thinking, oh, well, yeah. I'm you too? Weird that way.
All right. Well, I guess one of the other things that I was, man, it'll come back to me. I think I just blew a few bits off the hard drive there. Alex?
No, I'm just trying to get my head wrapped around what the social constructionism whole concept is. So you can tell me if I'm wrong. So basically what they're saying is that gender roles are basically just how you're raised and nothing biological component to that at all. Is that what that is?
Completely.
Yeah. Okay.
You can see where I've kind of going crazy here. Yeah.
I think because typically, like, since the beginning of time, and I'm not saying that there are definitely outliers in that, especially at this point in time, but children or women have basically raised children, and that's what they were biologically kind of designed for, and the men protected and provided for the women. If I'm wrong.
No, well, I don't think you're wrong. I think you're right on. I interrupted you, did I?
No,
it's fine.
No, I meant having.
No, it's fine. I've got. Okay. I guess one thing I was okay since you opened it up. One thing I was going to say is, I definitely agree, right? I mean, there's definitely instinct. There are patterns that come from thousands of years of evolution of existence, I guess, right? That kind of predefine some traits and characteristics, right? And I think, society at large, modern society at large, does quite a lot to soften those instincts, to use that social constructionism, et cetera, to modify some of the innate behaviors, et cetera. Right. And I think that's not always a bad thing if you look at it. I think we were far more predisposed to violence back in the hunter-gatherer days. If you encroach on my territory, you're a threat that needs to be eliminated. Whereas now we, have more tolerance for that, and we use a system that is more, kind. I don't know.
That's debatable. There's still quite a few violent people out there.
A couple here and there. 100% true. But I guess the point I'm making is that has to also be considered as part of this, right? I mean, even evolutionary psychologists would have to admit that yes, those traits exist. However, as we grow up, even just a homeschooled child, their parents are going to influence some of that instinctual behavior to become more positively channeled for children, right? So that it's not this, tribal, type of warring clans, if you will.
Well, I'm not sure I know how to respond to that. First of all, no one would ever say, I think, no evolutionary psychologist anyway, would say that culture is not important. It is. Right. The very fact that we have things like money means that there's social construction going on. Money has no value unless we give it value in society. However, I find it kind of strange that people would, say, okay, if you're masculine, culture made you that way, when in fact masculinity is strongly tied to testosterone, and testosterone is 10 times higher in males than females, and there's no question that testosterone tends to make men more violent. But for the feminists and those that agree with the feminists to say that men are toxic because some men are violent is simply wrong, in my opinion. And a gentler world is better than a violent world, but we also should give some breath here to our instincts and be careful, because there are some good things about masculinity, being that you need to get violent sometimes to protect your family if they're attacked, or anyone that wants to take freedom away from us, for example, we may want to think twice about, not being violent. So I would say ultimately, I would agree with you, but I would caution that sometimes these things seem too good to be true. For example, and Alex, I think you mentioned it, you know, culture is important, but if you turn out to be gay, I've failed to see how culture could have impacted you to be gay. And yet that's basically what the feminists are saying, because if you talk to gays, for example, they would say, oh, I'm that way because I was born that way. And I think that there's probably a lot of truth in that. The wiring may get screwed up somewhere, or some of it might be, you know, there's been some evidence that suggests that there's a role played by genetics in this. So it's hard then to see how society could make someone gay when in fact everybody's reinforced for being, or used to be anyway, everybody was reinforced for being straight, and there was a lot of anti-reinforcement for those that weren't straight. I mean, look at Turing. Mm-hmm. He basically killed himself because society was so cruel to him. I think we can say most definitely that a lot of the way we are is due to genetics and to the processes that come from genetics, like being bathed in testosterone when we're infants. Before we're even born, we get bathed, I think it's in the sixth week, in testosterone if we're males, and we don't if we're females. And then again, we get bathed in testosterone once we hit puberty. And, you know, this is something that I've never been able to understand from the feminist when they start talking about social constructionism. It seems like these kinds of things are ignored. And I'll just kind of leave it there.
Yeah, that's absolutely. And no disagreement here, right? I think there's, excuse me. I think there's some truth in both sides, and I think that there's it would be counter to ignore our biology, right? I mean, at the end of the day, it, you know, as you said, right, testosterone, and I think it is. I remember it's in that I think, yeah, first trimester that you get that big wash of testosterone. And like you said, at puberty as well, that's biology, right? The male physiology is doing this to prepare the body as it grows and changes.
Well, our brains are literally different too than females. So.
Yep. And our, a lot of our drives and desires, and obviously these are all generalizations. There are outliers everywhere, right?
Always.
So I want to make sure that we, you know, acknowledge that is the case.
But well, that's why I was talking about gay men. You know, they right. are.
Or women, sure, yeah.
Yeah, or gay women, yeah.
Yeah, it's a, you know, but to be able to identify things that are, you know, very much the nature of our physiology as a human, right? And that's not changeable. What do you think is a workable solution to this? Higher learning, right? There are, without question, elective classes out there that I always questioned. There are, you know, courses and minors that are out there that I'm not certain why, but, you know, hey, it's an interesting subject or topic. So given that, what do you think is a reasonable way to kind of, you know, take this super tanker, because education operates a lot like government does. And once it starts down a direction, it doesn't just, you know, flip a U-turn and go the other way. So what do you think are reasonable ways to start to steer that tanker so that it starts going more towards something that has, you know, scientific rigor? And I hesitate to even use, you know, scientific as well, because I think a lot of these are arts, right?
What would be an art? I'm sorry. Maybe I misunderstood.
Art like some of the more, you know, what is it? What are we, fourth or fifth wave feminism? Aren't they more, you know, like art studies? They're not grounded in science, right?
Like psychology. You know, if they
psychology,
are,
psychology
if they are grounded in science or not, I mean, if they're in the arts, I can't speak to it, you know?
Okay. So my take on that, right, is like psychology as a degree is an art major, right? It's a bachelor of arts or a master's of arts. No, it is science.
Well, it is. It's in the social sciences.
Okay.
Typically.
Social sciences.
But evolutionary psychology is beginning to have an impact on it. And it's becoming much more rigorous with time. There'd be a lot of psychologists that would be irritated by that statement, but
well, that's all right.
I hope they're impacting it.
So I know this would be a horrible experiment to do. I don't know if it's ever been done before, but are there any cases of like children being reared by not being in a social construct, and what would result from that? Like a feral child or something like that?
Well, feral children are good examples of why we want to pay attention to culture, because, you know, if you lock a kid up in a closet and come back in 18 years, you're going to basically have an animal. And it's happened, by the way. There have been some children that have had terrible things happen to them like that. And they were totally unsociable after, or you know, the inability to socialize them after those impacts. And so, culture does play an important role. I was going to get back to your I guess it was your comment about change. When we did some terrible things, I think back in the 60s and 70s, we tried to change gay men to straight, you know, either through reinforcement learning or those kinds of things. And, it didn't work. In fact, it turned out to be a bad experiment, if you can look at them as experiments. So it just goes to show you, I think, how strong the biology aspect of all of this is rather than the cultural. I know I haven't gotten to your question in an answer, but I'm not sure how to answer it, because what I focused on in my paper with the feminists wasn't anything to do with what may be an art, a profession like, you know, art. I was sticking mainly to things that could be documented with data. And certainly there's been a lot of research on this. And people write this off as nurture versus nature, but I don't even think that hits it on the head. Social constructionism, the way I see it anyway, and you can disagree with me if you want, I see it as feminism trying to change our society so that men and women will behave similarly. And from my perspective, I don't think that's as easy as they think it is. And yet these experiments and trying to get men and women to behave the same to do the same jobs even is complex, and it's not easy to change our society in the way that they think it should be changed. And I think a lot of, particularly young men, have been hurt by some of the changes that have been going on in our society due to woke and various other things.
Yeah, I think there's there's without question a lot of, you know, again, ingrained tendencies in, you know, male or female, you know, individuals. Risk taking being a huge one, right? You just don't see female line workers.
Yes.
Right?
Women are very risk averse, not just in physical construction things, but in also in jobs that require, you know, 80-hour weeks. Women steer away from those like mad. So if you're wondering why we don't get a lot of women competing in STEM or computer science or those, they don't want the hassle. They want the flexibility to be able to have off time, and they don't understand why men don't, you know. So
yeah.
And being a man, I understand why, because, you know, I think I think a lot of my self-worth is wrapped up in how I do my job. I can't put it any other way, although I'm not sure I have the answer to that.
Yeah, I always describe it as a desire to win. I don't know why, but it's
competitive.
It is. Yeah. It can be the most inane thing.
Yeah.
And I have to win. Like I have to make this. This has to work. It's going to. This will happen.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then success becomes a very important part of your life, and so I think that we're trying to make men more like women, to the loss of a lot of men and being hurt by this, I think. To some extent.
Do you have any idea what the rationale is for that? I understand the idea, the ideas that are espoused. I don't necessarily agree with them because I think that there is data to show that a number of these things are, something you could easily call out, but you can't put numbers to or drive real data and real, Socratic method against, right? Things like, toxic masculinity, patriarchy as the oppressor, right? And I think, it's an interesting one to me, right? This is a very, very interesting topic, and part of
I agree.
Part of the hesitation here is making sure that I say things in the right manner anymore, because
I think that very thing causes a lot of men to they're tiptoeing around in the university. Now, I work in a university environment, so, I see that aspect of the world. Maybe my aspect is different, but I see men, almost cowering on university campuses because of fear. They might say the wrong thing or get canceled or whatever else goes on. And ultimately, to get into this, guys, I'd like to go into a little bit of the evolution part, and then maybe we can talk about the specifics, because I have major criticisms on what women are calling, or what feminists are calling, the patriarchy. I don't think it's this terrible thing where men get together on the weekends and try to figure out how to suppress women. And maybe you guys are going to meetings, but I'm not.
You didn't get the invite?
I didn't get the message, no.
Oh, all right. I'll forward that to you later.
Okay.
Kidding.
So it really is true, though, to some extent. I mean, I've heard women say, the patriarchy is this oppression of women, and it's our society is filled with it. And what they may be seeing as an oppressive system is really due to women's choice. And I think I can explain that if you let me go back and talk a little about evolution.
Absolutely.
Well, let me go back about 4 to 7 million years ago when we had ancestors that walked upright. We have fossils that go back that far to critters that walked upright. And something very interesting, our ancestors had a brain back then, a little bit bigger than a chimpanzee. And within 4 or 5 million years, we have then the brains of the current day Homo sapiens, which are quite large. And in a very short period of time, we have gone from, almost chimpanzee size to our size. It's like almost overnight, geologically speaking. And this led to a lot of things in hunter-gatherer society that changed. For example, large brains require the brain to be delivered early. So we can't have the woman carrying a baby. We can't. I mean, you can't physically and naturally carry a baby to term. So babies are born with only 25% of their brain developed, and they come out very, very helpless. And of course, even with the expansion of women's hips to make it easier for our large brains to come out, even that has not been enough in order to birth babies with completely developed brains. This is very unusual in the animal kingdom. Think about a deer. I don't know if you've ever seen a deer born, but boy, they come out running, boy. I mean, it's like, and if you're not, you're going to get eaten by a predator. So there's a big difference here. And when you're out on a savanna and you've got a helpless child in your hands, it does a couple of things. Number one, it makes a woman pretty much totally, if she's going to take care of her child, there's a lot of inability then to go out and feed the child and her without some help from the man. So what do we see? We see men then, or we see women then trying to choose men that are going to be able to give what we call male parental investment, which is unusual in the animal kingdom. Usually men just give the sperm and move on, or males do. And so this male parental investment is basically a kind of a contract. It is, you help me raise the kid and I'll give you access sexually. And that's kind of agreed on, even though we don't realize it maybe. And today's society, of course, we lose a lot of that because we have the pill. So women can be much more free. But I think anybody that's dated realizes that women are a lot less willing to have indiscriminate sex than men are. Funny research done on that. A woman took her class. She was a research professor, and she had her class of graduate students go out and ask people in the libraries on campus, both men and women. Women would ask men, and men would ask women if they would go home and have sex with them that night. And the I think 100% of the women, not surprisingly, said no, and 75% of the men said yes. The other 25% gave reasons why they couldn't, feeling guilty almost that they couldn't, like I'm married or, you know, whatever the excuse they gave. I think that kind of sums it up pretty well, that men are much more willing to have indiscriminate sex, and there's a good reason for it, because women might end up pregnant and having to raise a child in a hunter-gatherer society. That's a pretty devastating situation if you're faced with raising a child alone on the savannah. Now, I know it's not completely alone. There's families there and all that, but it's a burden on the family if you end up in that situation. And yet, how do we carry this over into modern day society? Well, we carry this over in seeing it happen. You know, even though women are able to have, you know, indiscriminate sex if they want, for the most part, they choose, you know, not to most of the time. Now, I know there are exceptions to that rule, but in general, they are more reluctant than men. So another thing, women started choosing men also that could protect the family, and they started choosing men that could bring home the resources. So remember, out on a savanna where you're hunting big game, you know, it's quite dangerous. Big game is hard to bring down, and it takes a lot of work and takes a lot of coordination, usually among men, because women were raising children. So although women could do gathering of seeds and things like that, it was mainly the men that went out and did big game hunting. And it's dangerous. And so you need brave men to go out there and do that. You also need brave men to protect the family. Think about tribes. Almost all tribes faced adversaries from other tribes. And so if a tribe won, it was bad news for the guys. All of them got killed. And it was bad news for the women because they basically took them home with them and they became their wives. So as brutal as that may sound, that was the way nature was for millions of years of our evolution. And so we, you know, we see some of that left over today in our society. And, you know, I know for me, when I started reading about evolutionary psychology in the 90s, it answered a lot of questions for me. It's like, well, you know, why am I attracted to beautiful women rather than, you know, what we would consider homely women? I thought, that's nearly not fair. You know, I shouldn't be that way. Well, I should be that way because beauty is associated with health. And so men are really looking for healthy women when we try to find attractive women, and also youth. Men men want young women because there's more chance of having children over a lifetime with women that are young. So I know my work in Panama on volcanoes down there, the tribes I ran into, I was seeing 12-year-old girls in the process of getting married. And, that's something you wouldn't see in our society today. So, they're reaching puberty and they're like, okay, time to get married. And so, yes, 12 years old, you can have a lot of children from 12 to 40 or whenever, you hit the point where you can't have children anymore if you're a woman. So that's good for men and women to produce offspring, more offspring. Today, of course, it's all bets are off. Men and women don't choose to have as many babies as they can. But up until recently, that was true pretty much all over the world, except perhaps the Western world, where people had a lot of children. Even in the Western world.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Men have a lot of children.
Up until the, early 1900s, that was kind of how we operated.
Yes.
Start looking at your own family
Victorian
tree.
England.
Yeah, look at your own family tree. And,
oh, yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
It wasn't more than great-grandfather or grandfather at this point that had, maybe 9, 10, 11 children, right? And nowadays it's one. Maybe two, if any.
I had a lot of great-great-grandparents that had 12 kids, Not a lot, but I had a number of them.
My grandmother is one of 13, I think.
Ooh, just the thought of raising 13 kids. Whoa.
Right. One-room house in a coal mining town.
What were they thinking?
Right?
I've heard comments like, people asking, well, what did people do back then? They must have been bored before the internet, but I'm pretty sure I knew what they were doing.
Well, they didn't have television. There wasn't much to
exactly.
do except read.
Read and make children.
You couldn't do that at night if you didn't have a lamp. So,
yeah.
So the thing that I was getting back to was this choice by women. Think about that. They're choosing high testosterone men, basically. We find in these cultural studies where people have gone out and asked, 60,000, there have been huge studies like this where they ask 60,000 people across all cultures they can get their hands on. And one of the things they find is that women across all cultures, that is, it suggests biology and not social construction, across all cultures, women are looking for men that have a high ability to bring home resources. And on the other hand, men are looking for women that are attractive. So right away, you've got this huge dichotomy in the way men and women choose their long-term spouses or boyfriends, if you want to look at girlfriends, if you want to look at it that way. And this choice becomes very important. Women are choosing men that are protectors, are people that can go out and earn the bacon, and also can defend them. So they're looking towards, somewhat masculine men, at least, not feminized men in general for those kinds of things. And so you can see where, extrapolating this to modern day civilization, where men might be in charge of society. Women in hunter-gatherer society gave up leadership roles to men because they really didn't have time to be in leadership. They didn't want leadership. They wanted to raise children. They were maternal. They had high contents of estrogen, in their bloods. Men had testosterone. They were, in general, making decisions for the tribes and leadership roles. So, yes, I think we did have what we would consider discriminatory behavior towards women in the in the 1800s and even in the 1900s. But that's to be expected, and even a patriarchy. But I would call that an evolutionary patriarchy, and I did in this paper. You can see where men evolved into something we would call a patriarchy because women were choosing them to be that way. So is it the fault of men that we have, this so-called patriarchy? No, not if we're not discriminating against women, and we're not. So I think we have to kind of now give way to women, that's very good because we want everyone to have equal opportunities in our society. But do we really need to punish men to get women in equal abundances in every group? Well, we find out from economists and a lot of women economists that women don't want to go into fields that have this high competitive 80-hour work week or in fields like STEM or, yeah, some women do, and those women, we should open our arms to them coming into fields. But do we need to spend $3 million funding National Science Foundation to figure out how we can get more women into STEM? How about just letting them do what they want to do? And if they choose STEM, more power to them. If they don't, well, let's not discriminate against men so we can get women into those. And I think that's where we start seeing where men are being hurt by some of these DEI initiatives. So that's controversial, I know, and maybe you get me in trouble, but I got to speak my mind.
I don't see how, right? I mean, there's data to back that up, right?
Data never stopped the feminists in my department.
Well, if you want to refute it, go gather data and put together a paper and show how it's wrong. And hey, I support anyone in their efforts to do something like that. Go for it.
I do too.
That's what the Socratic method is about, right? That's what we should all be looking to do. And I do think it's interesting though, because you know STEM keeps coming up, and it is true, right? And then you look at fields where you know you can. I mean, arguably the medical field is full of, you know, basic, you know, the STEM principles and properties. However, at least last I looked, I think it's gotten to be a majority female dominated field.
And medical has to go.
Yeah. And I think one of the interesting things there, and it plays back to evolutionary psychology, is that that is a role with a high degree of care that goes into it. It's not uncaring, cold, scientific, hard fact. Not. It is a bit of that and a bit of caring. And, you know, there's more to it. And I think that right there is the thing that really, at least in my eyes, really kind of makes those fields, the STEM fields, less attractive to women. It's cold, it's calculating, and it's uncaring. Data doesn't care if you like the numbers or not. Data doesn't care if the numbers agree with you or not, right? It's just data.
But this is where I take issue with feminists, because they have this cancel culture where, you know, if you don't agree, I don't know if you're familiar with Helen Andrews or not, but she's written this wonderful paper called The Great Feminization. It just came out late last year. And she is claiming that woke has been generated by women because they have now become dominant in these fields. You know, there are more lawyers that are women, there are more judges that are women, there are more educators that are women, you know, more professors, for example. More women get PhDs, more women get master's degrees, more women get undergraduate degrees. So we might be seeing the birth of wokeism as something that has been generated because women are very hesitant to have free speech. They don't like free speech as much as men do, and they tend to want to stifle any disagreement because they want to have no conflicts in the society. They want everything to run smoothly. This may be one of the reasons why they're trying to get men to behave more like women. And that's where the great feminization comes from. I could go into some other things that she goes into, but I find that to be very, very telling and interesting.
It definitely is interesting.
And DEI would be women are much more caring about other people. And you can see how this plays in DEI. They want to make sure that everyone's treated fairly in hiring. It's a good idea, but when you start discriminating against the more meritorious, then you run into some bad things for society. I can guarantee you that the Chinese are not trying to to get, you know, everybody and high diversity in their society. They're interested in getting the best doing it. And ultimately, that's who we're competing against. And I find that feminists misunderstand how competitive the world is. I mean, if you come from evolution, you know, it's almost basically you understand how competitive it is all the time for both men and women.
I recall hearing someone, and I can't for the life of me remember where I heard this, but I think it stuck with me. Not because necessarily I agree or disagree with this, right? But you know, the desire to mitigate conflict as a norm, right? And that right there, I could see some merit to that, right? I mean, we've been around, we live in, you know, the supposed enlightened society that we live in, yet we still have a problem where we can't seem to stop killing people. You know, okay, so maybe there's some room for, you know, a toning down of that in certain areas. But at the same time, it is something I see as being innate in, you know, human nature in general. So I guess it's, yeah, I don't know. For me, it becomes a conundrum where you can have a good idea, but the getting there part is destructive in its nature.
Well, certainly, how can I disagree with that? I mean, anything, you know, that helps conflict, helps to avoid conflict is good. Although I think men tend conflict at some extent.
And I was going to say, I wouldn't say conflict in general. I would say conflict when it escalates to violence.
Oh, right? Yeah, absolutely.
I think it's necessary. Conflict in the world of, you know, the world of business is necessary. Without it, we get terrible products that never get better. You know, it's necessary in medical and science and everywhere else, because you have to, you know, continuously test theories. You have to continuously test, is this actually accurate? Did I just find something that makes this no longer true or relevant? Even Einstein's theory of relativity is still under pressure, and there are areas where it's cracked. Right. And that's not a bad thing. And that is
not conflict. To my knowledge, but I'll go ahead and defer to you on that.
I think it was the black holes where some of his theory has cracked on some of those. And I can't repeat it verbatim, but if you look it up, there are some big question marks there.
Yeah. Well, not to get off the subject, but yeah, I think science is always going to challenge Einstein. Or any ideas that are out there.
And it should. So, yeah. And that is conflict, right? And that's not a bad thing. Conflict can be great, and the outcome of conflict can be great. So, you know, it's a tough one, because on the flip side, yeah, sure, I'd love to see less conflict. I'd like to see us not have to make bombs anymore to drop on people. I think that'd be cool, you know?
Well, there's also game theory, which comes into all of this, and ultimately, in game theory, you've got to consider what your opponents are doing. So, for example, I don't think anybody wants to have nuclear weapons running around, but as long as your enemy has them, you need them. And we may have experienced the immense amount of peace that we've had since World War II. On the fact that the atomic bomb was developed, because it's kept people perhaps from having world wars, knock on wood. I hope we don't have any more world wars. But throughout my life anyway, haven't seen any world wars. And looking back on the ones prior to my birth, it's God, you know, godsend that we haven't had them.
Yeah, without question.
But game theory becomes very important in the way you look at this too. So maybe we need some people that are willing to be violent, and I'm not making light of being violent, but are willing to be violent to protect us from those on the other side that are willing to be violent. And I think it's a kind of a tit for tat.
It's like that basis. It's like that that adage, right? Better to be a warrior in a garden than a gardener in a war.
Oh, yeah. I think that's a pretty good saying.
Yeah.
But I was getting to, what was I getting to? This this change. I would argue, based on some of the things I've just told you, that because feminism is geared towards social constructionism, fat studies, where, you know, they're saying that you can be healthy and fat and overweight, obese, for example, at the same time, is doing a disservice. We need people searching for the truth on university campuses. And those that want to have ideologies or promote political ideas, those should probably be in think tanks, not on university campuses. So I'm arguing that feminist studies be removed from campuses, where they can function as whatever they function as, political entities, where they don't have to worry necessarily about getting the evidence and data to back up their ideas. Whereas in the university campus, when you're talking to young students with young minds, I think you should be supporting your data and your information. I know that's controversial, but it's certainly a scientist's view of the world.
I guess I would struggle to find the controversy in education being based around solid, you know, data, facts, or fact finding. Right, there may be a lack of data somewhere, and that's a great place to write a thesis. Right,
right.
But you know, and that again furthers that data-driven approach to education.
Well, take fat studies for example. I was literally astounded to find that there were people saying health at any size. And yeah, you can be healthy like a sumo wrestler and be very healthy, but almost obese. But that's a whole different story than a sedentary person who's overweight and saying, oh, that person can be healthy too. Or that the patriarchy makes us not to like overweight women, and that culture is forcing us only to be attracted to attractive women. That's just not, that doesn't make any sense. And I'll certainly be the first to say that we shouldn't discriminate against people that are overweight or obese, but telling students that it's okay, you know, to be overweight is just not thinking about them. It's not thinking about their health. And yet it's just running rampant in the fat studies literature. The whole idea is so.
That's actually a new one to me. I didn't know that there was a track for that.
Fat studies has been in feminist studies for quite some time.
Decade?
Longer than that. I was criticizing it way back in the 90s.
Interesting.
In fact, it's almost gotten to a point where some feminists, I wouldn't say all of them, some overweight feminists are proud of the fact that they're overweight and that, you know, we'll stick it to the man here, you know. That's the mentality that I see on campus sometimes. Look, you know, if you want to be overweight, that's fine with me. I just don't, I would hate to see them teaching young women and that's mostly who, you know, they get in their feminist studies. They don't allow men in for the most part. So you get only women hearing this. And that seems to be a bad situation.
I find irony in the celebrities that say it's okay to be obese, and they sing about it and talk about it, and then they disappear for a couple of months, and they come back, and they're thin as a pencil. And you're like, I thought it was okay. But
well, don't get me wrong. I want to make this point. I think there's some bad things that we have in society. For example, it may be very bad that we tend to have supermodels out there, and we're using those models to convey to women that this is the way you should look, because that leads to things like bulimia, and we don't want to hurt women like that. So we've got to be careful, I think, as men, to watch out on that. There, I just kind of leave it there, I guess.
No, and I think that is important, right? I think, and it's also interesting to think, what we see today as being beautiful. Again, let's go back 100 years. That wasn't the standard of beauty. People oftentimes the more, portly you were, the more well-to-do you were, right? I think that, extended back for, millennia, right? At the same time, I think overall, there's been a big shift, and I agree with you on the supermodel part immensely. I spent a period of my life doing, counseling, if you will, for people that had various disorders, and eating disorders were one of them. It's honestly one of the most challenging things that you can.
I can imagine.
Drug addiction holds no
food
candle.
Addiction is really, sugar addiction.
Well, food addiction in general, drug addiction holds zero candles to it, right? At the end of the day, you're literally, it would be like going to a heroin addict and say, okay, you have to take 3 of these a day, but you can't do more than this little teeny amount, and only at these 3 times a day. You know what I mean? Extremely challenging. And like you said, that body dysmorphia that comes about in a soft pressure way, right? It's not even that anyone's outwardly saying that this is what you should strive to look like. It's that it's pervasive and known as the ultimate signal of beauty, right?
Yes, and to go back to what you're saying, there have been all kinds of studies that have shown that men differ slightly in within one culture. They will choose a whole set of women beauty, and they will rank them, and then men outside that culture will rank the same women, and they might rank them a little differently, but the ones that they see beautiful and are the ones that people outside the culture see beautiful, and vice versa. So people tend to think women in their own culture are the most beautiful, but outside of their culture, they would say, okay, we agree on who's beautiful. And it also turns out that weight plays a role. There are some cultures, no doubt, like you mentioned, where overweight people are a sign of having great wealth. And these come in cultures where there is shortages of food. And so you can see why there would be a real emphasis on beauty in a culture where there are problems getting food. But other than that, I think we have pretty much the same standards across cultures as to what is beautiful, even though we may think women in our own culture. And this goes for women too. Women also like attractive men. Women are much more likely, for example, to cheat with attractive men, but marry someone that isn't so attractive, because they're basing their long-term relationship on how much resource he can bring in, as opposed to his looks. So, kind of interesting, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Alex?
No, I don't know. Like you said, there's a lot of complexity to it, because you think about what to say. Then they're like, I don't know if I want to say that, because it might offend the wrong person or something. I don't know.
But yeah, we have to be careful. I agree.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, I think, you know, from my standpoint, it's more about it's more about making sure that the message is what I wanted to say than it is the content of it, right? A lot of people misconstrue what someone says as being something completely different, or take something out of context. And
don't I know?
Yeah, right. And so that, I think, is one of the things, for me at least, that you know, causes me pause and to kind of, how do I want to word this and frame this so that it doesn't come across as like, aha, I gotcha. You know what I mean? Someone else could say that, right? Instead, it comes across as a statement that I meant to say, and with the meaning that I had behind it, you know, which is sad, because
it is.
We didn't used to have to self-censor as much, you know? And I think the free exchange of ideas needs a revival, honestly.
It sure does. I agree 100% on that.
I was just kind of thinking about the relationship my wife and I have, and you know, it's not like I'm above her or she's above me or whatever. I kind of think of it like a car, and like someone's the engine, someone's the transmission, but we can't do both the same job, but we both are necessary to make the car go somewhere. That's kind of how I think about it.
Well, I think that my wife and I, we've been married for 40 years, and I think one of the way we share ideas is that we both said, okay, it's pretty much everything for the kids, you know. Well, yeah, we can have our own lives, but we were very focused on what would be best for our kids. So she stayed home when she first had kids for, I don't know, I want to say 6 or 7 years, and then went back to work after that. But she really wanted to stay home. And I made sure that I married someone that wanted to stay home, because I didn't want children raised, you know, outside of a, what do I want to say, where both parents worked. So, and my wife really wanted that too. I'm not saying that's best for everybody, but I think ultimately, though, it's good for the kids.
Well, I think there's a lot of value to that, right? And, you know, I would say nowadays it's become exponentially more difficult to achieve that level of independence in being able to do that. We don't, at least, you know, not in quite some time, we haven't lived in a world where, you know, a single family or a single family with children can have a single person working and be able to do that and provide in a manner that is...
Well, we went without a lot to do that. I mean, we did, but it was consciously done. So.
Sure, sure. And I mean, even more so today, right?
I think so.
I look at the price of things.
Right? Oh, yeah.
And especially, and this is going to be dependent on your age and a number of other factors, but in general, if you're under 30 and you're out there wanting to start a family, I think it's going to be a really, really difficult thing to put yourself in a position where you can have a single working parent and one that stays home. I think financially, it's just almost, you know, it's near impossible unless there was something set up, some form of generational wealth or something that allows you at least some breathing room, or you were really, really good with finances and managed to put together a solid nest egg, right?
Yeah, that's one of, I think, the bad outcomes of feminism was that, you know, we sort of forced a situation in our society now where both men and women have to work. And I think, you know, it kind of hurts the kids. You have a lot of lock-key kids now coming home and, you know, or having to go when they're younger off to, you know, to, I wouldn't say be raised by someone else, but certainly they don't get to be around their parents as much as they would.
You're certainly getting input from people that may or may not share the same values and ideas that you do, right?
Correct.
And yeah, I would also say, you know, understanding where you're coming from, I would say a large part of this is due almost directly to fiscal policy and some of the things that we have done with our system of economy at this point. You know, the fact that, you know, we operate on debt and you know, have essentially devalued our own currency by printing money and increasing the supply has a lot to do with that, right? I certainly think that the civil rights movement was a good thing. I really do. And I think, you know, women being, you know, I think it's, you know, in my lifetime, women couldn't, you know, own a home or have a bank account. Let me take that back. They couldn't buy a home because they couldn't get a loan and they couldn't take a, you know, get a bank account or a credit card in my lifetime. Right. And I think that's, I mean, it's a wonderful thing that that doesn't exist. But, you know, there's also a big question mark on, you know, how much of a role that played in kind of creating some of the economic conditions that caused, you know, more workforce came about almost overnight. And, you know, obviously, you know, we increased the supply.
Yep. I agree.
You're talking about the detriment of having both parents working. I think it's even worse, you know, these single parent homes where there's no father around for a lot of them. I don't think it does anybody any favors either.
I would agree with you. And this, of course, is something that feminists do not like to talk about. But I think eventually it has to be addressed. You know, is it in the interest of your kids, best interest of your kids to not have a parent around? And if it isn't, is there a way to work around it?
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think there's a lot of room for improvement in that. You're not, you know, obviously not going to get rid of the underlying, you know, reason for that. But, you know, what happens afterwards? I think there's a huge amount of room for improvement in the system. And part of it being, barring, you know, the extreme circumstances, for that being a complete and total, in this case, I would say an equitable split.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Not big on equity in general, but in that one, I think there's a merit to equity, because it makes the most sense for the children and for the, you know, consistency of the family unit.
Right.
All right. Well, I think we're probably at a fairly decent place for starting to wrap things up.
Okay.
Really appreciate your time. And
thank you for having me.
I think this was a great conversation.
Yeah, it was.
So one question we always ask our guests is, you know, I think it's important for us to be able to recognize individuals or you know, people that had a significant impact on our lives. So one person you'd like to give a shout out to for having that positive impact in your life could be sixth grade science teacher, it could be a professor, it could be an author, it could be a historical figure, it could be anyone.
Well, it seems rather easy to me. You know, short of making my father the choice, I think, because my father was a great influence on me, but I would say Darwin. Charles Darwin has basically given us evolutionary psychology. He was so great. I still have on my calendar when his birthday rolls around, which was here in February just recently. And just that one man could see so much, you know, not only did he come up with natural selection, but he came up with sexual selection, which is what I was talking about earlier, how women choose men. that's sexual selection. You know, if we have a red cardinal flying around, Darwin said, that doesn't make much sense. How does that work? Because red cardinals seem to be obvious things that animals could eat over not being red. Well, yes, there's competition there. The red cardinal wants to be selected by females. That's why they're red, because for whatever reason, females like red cardinals, but so do cats. So, you know, you're rolling the dice there. And you get your genes passed on by being red. And by the way, we see that among humans to some extent. Men are much bigger risk takers than women in general. I mean, I know we have a lot of risk takers out there that are women, but men are generally more bigger risk takers. And so and it's one of the reasons why men die so young. Men tend to die much younger than women. And by the way, men kill men much more than they kill women. And that's all back to this competition thing. So it all seems to make sense in a big picture kind of way. But yes, Darwin, I would go Darwin.
Awesome. That's an interesting choice. At least it wasn't Maslow. Sorry.
Sorry.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time. Do you want
thank
to
you
take,
guys.
Take a little bit of time and tell people what you're working on, what you've got going on, anything, you know, point them in a direction?
Yeah, I've just gotten involved with the Comet Research Group. This is a group that thinks that, and I agree with them, that thinks that at the end of the Younger Dryas, which existed about 12,800 years ago, something struck a comet, might have been a meteorite, might have been many probably, that struck Earth and caused perhaps the end of the megafauna, you know, the mastodon, the woolly mammoths, the saber-toothed tigers, and maybe even Clovis culture here in North America. So very interesting, finding a lot of evidence for it. So, yeah, that's what I'm working on. If I could say so, if you want to see some of the papers I've written, you can check me out at markdefant.com. It's MercDefant. And if you want to contact me, you can find my email there too, if you'd like.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, that's an interesting one, and one I've been following for a bit of time as well.
So. Oh, you know about it, though. Okay.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I Good. Can't remember the gentleman's name at this point. I can see his face, but that I was introduced to the theory of this by a while back, and I was like, and then I started, you know, looking at what was being presented, and I was like, okay, well, maybe this makes sense, you know? So it's an interesting thing. So that's pretty cool. All right. Well, thank you again for joining us.
It's good being with you guys. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you again for watching us for another episode of the Space Tomatoes podcast. You know where to find us. We're everywhere, literally everywhere. Just go type in the Space Tomatoes podcast and you'll find us. YouTube, Spotify. We're now on Fountain.fm. So if you want to go check us out there, support us through Fountain, you can. And we also are now on Noster, which is a protocol and censorship resistant because nobody owns your account except you. So check that out too. And remember, wherever you are, whenever you're watching this, have an amazing day.
See you, everybody.